This is tape one of interview with Congressman Adam Clayton Powell. Proceed.
Admiration for him, but you know what's the trouble with those kind of books?
What's that?
Times are moving so fast that they're outdated. By the time they go through the process of publication, which is usually 6 months,
yes,
they're outdated. And yes. Silverman, really, as Malcolm X said, he knows probably as much about the Black Revolution as any white man. But his book, I could tell by the way he had me in there in footnotes, that by putting me in footnotes and other people in footnotes, he was desperately trying, the publishers, try to update it.
Yes. I don't want this to be topical in that sense. Mm-hmm. I want that many of the personalities that are available now, as it were, will remain important in varying ratios, and some new names will appear.
That's right.
But this is a matter of a lag of 3 months, I should say, before the book's out anyway, or four. So things will change.
Yes.
But at least the quality of personality will remain important.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a very explosive summer.
It's bound to be,
and
yes.
So if it's out 3 or 4 months, it's going to be...
Well, the magazine will be out sooner, of course, the magazine version.
Mm-hmm.
May I plunge ahead?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
On the train, on the telephone the other day, you said to me that you thought that the old leadership, by and large, was finished.
Yes.
The old line organization leadership was finished. Mm-hmm. Do you mind expanding that, please, sir?
Well, I think as most old leaders in all movements, they have not kept pace with the times. As I said in a sermon recently, let's trace the birth of an idea. It's born, it's rampant radicalism. It then becomes progressivism, then becomes liberalism, then it becomes moderate, then it becomes conservative, then it becomes outmoded, and then it's gone. And the old leadership has not brought forth new ideas, so the ideas they had have now become outmoded.
What do you conceive to be the function of your organization, ACT?
First, I do not belong to ACT. I have said this repeatedly. I have only participated in one of its meetings at the written request of the chairman, Mr. Landry of Chicago. And in the letter, he asked me to come and participate as, quote, a consultant, close quote. So as the grand old man of the Black Revolution, because I'll be 60 years old in 4 years, and these are all kids in their 20s, very few in their 30s even, I was there as a consultant. And I gave them certain definite advice based on my years of experience, because I led the first successful nonviolent campaign amongst Negroes in the United States for 11 years, from 1930 to 1941. And I quit in 41 because there's no more worlds to conquer, almost like Alexander the Great. But I don't mean that. Now we have new worlds to conquer. The Northern school desegregation, the housing, and the retraining of older Negroes for this new world, automation, and the training of our dropouts and pushouts for employment, upgrading, and political patronage commensurate with the Negro's balance of power in the big key electoral states.
In the question of most revolutionary social changes, in those situations, there's usually a drive towards centralization of leadership.
That's correct.
And almost always happens.
That's
that
correct.
That has not happened to this point.
Well, it's only 1 year old.
Revolt.
Only 1 year old. I think it's going to be a polarization. I think that these people who belong to ACT may be the catalytic agent in the polarization. Right now, all we hear among the demonstration leaders is a dissatisfaction, which is not constructive of the old leadership. Now, with a catalytic agent such as ACT, there might be produced a polarization, so we'll have the two poles. Right now, we do not have the poles. Eric Severide, by the way, I have it over there, commented in a column that in the Negro Revolution, the fight is not between the conservatives and the liberals. The fight is between the liberals and the extremists.
Well, how do you place ACT in that spectrum?
As a catalytic agent, a group fumbling around, trying to find something to hang its hat on.
Definitely stating before the press in Washington that they were not a new organization, that they, the exact words were, we want to be a clearinghouse. And I said, what you should do is to make your umbrella big enough to include everyone. And I pointed at Malcolm X, with whom I disagree ideologically, but who I have great admiration for some of his insights. I said,
he's had some great insights.
That's right. That's right. I'm glad you said that. I don't agree with the black Muslim movement. Don't agree with separation. So I did something which sounds like semantics before the ACT program, which they ate up. I said, let's don't fight for integration. Let's stop the fight. Let's fight for desegregation. And once we desegregate, then let each one go the way they want to. If the black nation wants to go to separation, let them go. I'm an integrationist.
That is, you make a sharp distinction then between integration and equality.
That's correct.
That the equality you take as a prior, as condition to integration.
Correct. Desegregation now. Then after that, let each one indulge in the luxury of whatever philosophical point of view they have.
But to deal with the matter of first, the civil rights approach, the FEPC approach, and...
No, we're not even concerned
with the civil rights. This is very important.
Well, let's distinguish that then.
If the Civil Rights Bill was passed in its entirety without any watering down amendments, it would not affect the black revolution in the North one bit.
Wait, in the South?
It would affect the South. You see, the black revolution is two-pronged.
Yes.
In the South, it's middle-class and upper-class Negroes, the preacher, the teacher, the student, and they're fighting for the golf courses and the swimming pools and the restaurants and the hotels and the right to vote. Those are the two primary thrusts. But when you leave the South, where only one-third of the Negroes now live, and come on into Washington, here you have a revolution of the masses, not the classes. And that's the revolution around the country. And that revolution is interested in the schools, housing, and jobs. And the Civil Rights Bill will not help that at all.
It would not, clearly, right. In a direct way.
No.
But
it would create a climate.
Yes.
It would create a climate.
The climate's important.
Yeah, climate's important.
One more question about this distinction between leadership and mass in the big northern cities.
Uh-huh.
This distinction leads to speculations as to how leadership can control. What's the relationship of leadership to that kind of a mass-based movement,
right,
of mass dissatisfaction?
Right. There is no leadership, the old line, nor the new, that can control the masses. One of the shocking statistics is that if you take the so-called Big Six of the civil rights organizations, the NAACP, Urban League, Martin Luther King, all that group, they don't have but 900,000 members. So you got, and many of those are white. So you have 19 million black people who are uncommitted by loyalty to the civil rights movement.
And what is the problem of leadership then? You have this vast mass of people, many of them deprived and dissatisfied and angry. Mm-hmm. What's the problem of leadership then?
All right, the problem of leadership is as follows. I have had here in Washington two summit meetings. They were not recorded by the press, although released to the press. Here, I think, is the quickest way to get into the heart of the masses. And if I wasn't so extremely busy with this tremendous committee I have, which handles 40% of the domestic legislation of the United States, I would really do it. I asked the Bureau of Census to give me the names of national organizations that were black-led, black membership, black-financed, and they gave them to me. They gave me the Masons, the Elks, the Oddfellows, the Knights of Pythias, the Doctors, the Lawyers, the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs.
It's by Negroes, which 10,000. Now, of course, there are many duplications.
The church, for instance, the Baptist Church, the AME Church, these have not yet been brought into the black revolution on a organizational basis. And that's where your mess is. So if someone could ever form a council of Negro organizations, they'd be getting right into the heart of the black masses. This was tried by E. Philip Randolph years ago in Chicago.
Yes, I remember that.
And he founded the National Negro Congress.
Yes, I remember that.
And the commies took that over.
Two things stem from that situation, as you've described it. One is that we know there's no social change without power involved.
That's
there's
correct.
No social change without some power.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take that title for the moment. Or what is the nature of the threat of this power. Power means a threat.
Uh-huh. What is the nature of this power and the nature of the threat it mounts?
Uh-huh. Threat to whom? The white man?
To the status quo.
Status quo, okay.
Whatever that is.
All right. As I said in my speech at Harvard Friday and at Indiana University last Monday, the white man is afraid today. He's afraid because all of the instruments of containment, of containing the Negro in his second-class status, he had a cartel. He monopolized these. Cut it off just a minute. Yeah.
All right, sir. Now, he had a cartel, a monopoly of all the instruments of containment. The National Guard, the police force, the dogs, the tear gas, the electric cattle prods, and the numerical superiority of 10-1. All of a sudden, Birmingham exploded, and the demonstrations began all over the country. And these are demonstrations based on the power of nonviolence. And you cannot stop nonviolence with violence. So the white power structure now stands aghast, wondering what to do in the face of these kids rolling out in the streets, these people marching with nothing but "we shall overcome someday."
That is, the technique of nonviolence you take as a decisive factor in Negro power.
The day the Negro changes from nonviolence to violence, he is finished, and the Black Revolution has to start all over again in some future date.
Now, there are some the Negroes in responsible positions, even collective organizations, that profess nonviolence, which speak, if not on the platform, and some on the platform, of brinksmanship of violence.
Yes.
The threat of violence as the uncontained thing which we would give you the responsibility of containing. Mm-hmm. Even sometimes suggested that a little provocation wouldn't do any harm. Mm-hmm. Now, I know this is the fact that he's a person who's a member of one of his big meetings. Mm-hmm. Told me that another member of that meeting had a memorandum: "We have got to get hurt on this. We've got to get some blood, or we are lost on this particular demonstration."
I totally disagree. Totally and completely. Now, may I pause for a minute? All right, thank you.
Well, back to our topic of leadership and the centralization of leadership. It's always true, apparently, that any competition for power or competition for policy, you find the process of overreaching entering very soon. One person promises more, offers more radical and more radical solutions. Uh-huh. This conforms entirely to the expectations as well as to personal strategies. Uh-huh. But this carries its dangers. How much danger of that do you see now?
I don't see any danger of that at all, except in the ranks of those self-proclaimed leaders who are trying to move up the ladder by virtue of these promises, because they have no other method of moving up the ladder.
How did you respond to the Reverend Gulamison's now well-advertised statement, the schools could be wrecked if not conforming to timetable of integration?
The schools could be wrecked.
Should be. Let the public schools be destroyed if necessary if they don't conform to his timetable of integration.
Well, I don't subscribe to that no more than I subscribe to the white segregationists destroying the public school system rather than obey the Supreme Court decision.
They're parallel.
They're exactly parallel.
In these matters of overreach, now, what about the stalling? That is an overreach, clearly.
Yeah, it's an overreach, but I was in favor of the stall-in, not knowing anything about the techniques nor the organization whatsoever, because to me, any form of demonstration that's non-violence necessarily quickens the thinking of people in the power structure.
Now, here's what I'm getting at. In terms of non-violent demonstrations, is there a distinction between the legitimate and the illegitimate? That is, those with different kinds of social reference. That is, the stalled ambulance and the stalled fire engine is one thing. Picketing or sitting in...
No, I don't think there's
any difference.
I see no difference. No, I say any form of non-violence has its effect.
Violence has an effect too, of course.
Yes, but I don't believe in it because I don't believe in violence totally, not just as a Negro. I just don't believe that violence has ever accomplished anything. You're a historian, and you know that better than I do, that the war and violence does not accomplish any satisfactory solution, such as our civil war, our world wars, making the world safe for democracy, and so forth. So I'm against violence, period.
Well, what about
demonstrations that are directed at specific targets, and those that are merely expressions of dissatisfaction or anger. Still nonviolent.
Yeah, I believe in demonstrations directed at specific targets, because whenever you have demonstrations of just bitterness and resentment and frustration with no goal in sight, then you're on the edge of something that could turn into violence.
Well, this then is the distinction between the Stalin has no objective. I'm saying this hypothetically, I'll say this, this is not an argument I'm saying, I say hypothetically has no objective in the sense of this picketing the Florida Pavilion has an objective, or Boy Scoot Boy.
Stalin had an objective to me, although, as I said, I never even met the leader of the Stalins until he came to Washington and never spoke to him more than 30 seconds.
Yes.
The Stalin had an objective in pointing up to people coming from all over the world, all over the United States, the lily white policy of the World's Fair itself. Second, the segregation and discrimination policies in the building of it. Third, for instance, the African Pavilion at the World's Fair was built entirely by white labor. No Negro worked on that at all. In a city where there are 1,200,000 Negroes and 800,000 Puerto Ricans.
Yes.
So I think the Stalin, in philosophically, I thought the Stalin had an objective in pointing that up.
Yes.
That was it for me. Now, if the leaders of the Stalin didn't have that as their target, then I say they were wrong.
Well, the point I was getting at was a different kind of social reference, you see. That's the picketing of the African Pavilion, or the fair itself is one thing that has a specific target. Mm-hmm. The other is refers to society in general and can have serious life or death consequences.
Yes, that's true. That's true. I agree with you on that.
That makes a real difference, doesn't it?
Yes, it does make somewhat of a difference, but I believe anyone goes into a demonstration must go into the demonstration with a view that there's life and death involved. All you need is one trigger-happy policeman.
Sure.
That's all, and it's all over, which has happened.
It's happened, that's happened, yes.
Yes, student nonviolent group SNCC has had four workers killed in the South.
Yes, workers killed. That's a question of the demonstrator himself taking his risk.
That's right.
Not the risk of the innocent person in an ambulance being whirled away to the hospital and being stopped on the road. That's a very different kind of risk.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. Agree with you on that.
Coming back to something else, how much apathy is there still in a place like Birmingham or a place like Harlem?
Well, I can't speak for Birmingham. All I can speak for is Harlem. I would say that the apathy in Harlem was massive until the Birmingham explosion. Now it has recovered from its lethargy and indifference because they thought they were so well off. We'd made all these gains back in the 30s and early 40s. And when the school demonstration was called first by Glamison, the New York Times, in recording statistics of the school demonstration, pointed out that my district, Central Harlem, was 92% absent from the classrooms. The nearest to us was Glamison's district, 68%, Bedford-Stuyvesant.
What about the question of Negro responsibility? Now, the white responsibility is clear in this crisis. There's no question about that. There's no use rehearsing it. What is the Negro responsibility?
I think the Negro responsibility is different than what you are probably thinking about. I think the responsibility of the Negro is to quicken the white man's responsibility into action.
He has no other responsibility than that?
Not right now. This is a time of crisis. This is a time of emergency. That's his responsibility. All this business about fixing up your houses and not spending money on luxury products and getting a better education. All those things right now have become secondary because this is a time of crisis. This is the year of decision. And therefore, the normal responsibility of the Negro, the long-range responsibility of the Negro,
has to be waived now for the present crisis.
Does the freshman in college suspend his studies?
If necessary, yes. If necessary, yes. He has to risk getting kicked out of school, if necessary.
That's something else, kicked out of school.
Mm-hmm. Everybody's got to take a risk. A chance. For now.
First, I was thinking of Dr. King's speech in Bridgeport a few weeks ago, which after his ordinary aggressive line, you see, this would have to be put there before what I'm going to say, otherwise it sounds different.
Yes.
He winds up, you see, with a not cast down your buckets where you are, but will you see, if you are, you know, the street sweeper, sweep that street. If you are the nuclear physicist, do that job. That way, associate.
Has a responsibility. Responsibilities must be waived in the face of the immediate crisis.
Well, suppose we have passed the immediate crisis. Suppose we have what we assume is the proper direction and at a speed would be acceptable.
Then we come back to the responsibilities that are the normal responsibilities of any group of people in the world.
That doesn't have a seem like an arbitrary distinction to you?
No, sir. To me.
There's another idea that floats around among sociologists. That segregation gives you the advantage of the disadvantage. There are people who profit from the disadvantage of segregation.
Oh, yeah, surely, yes. But that advantage, if you travel through Negro communities, is not of such a significant nature that it should stand in the way. Just a few people here and there profit from it, the Negro Insurance Company. Although the white insurance companies are now using actuarial tables to give Negroes the same as whites. The Negro Undertaker, or the one of our biggest undertakers in New York, is a white firm, Walter Cook, burying Negroes. The Negro doctor, anyone who will practice in the ghetto, where the ghetto is Italian, Jewish, upper, Sutton Place, all these are ghettos. The ghetto in me is merely a place. A group of people live who basically are the same race. I don't consider a ghetto necessarily a place of slums. I consider Sutton Place a ghetto.
You mean a gilded ghetto?
That's right. So anyone that practices in those areas is bound to succeed in those areas, succeeds by compulsion. But the advantages of segregation for the Negro are rapidly fading. That includes the church as well.
They're fading without reference to the revolution.
That's correct. They're fading because of the fact that the white people are beginning to open up their doors of business and employment, and there's no more place. Well, it's one of the threats to the whole American society. The chain stores wiping out the small businessmen, white as well as black. That's what's happening in Harlem.
Du Bois said long ago that he felt a great split between pull of a Negro tradition or even an African tradition, as well as prior to the American Negro tradition, and the pull of American Negro culture as opposed to the impulse, the pull toward the Western European American white society. That pull, this for some has created, some Negroes has created a very fundamental psychic split, a real problem, which is solved on one hand by people who go black Muslim, on the other hand, the people who
pass
into the white world entirely.
Yes. Both of those groups are infinitesimal.
They're extreme solutions.
That's right.
How real is the problem, you say, that problem?
I think that with the freedom of Africa and with the African nation's attitude towards the Negro in the United States, which is almost one of indifference, the Negro in the United States of America is more concerned with being an American with full rights than with preserving any African culture, which he doesn't know much about to begin with, and the Africans have not evinced much interest in the Black Revolution.
Forgetting Africa, though, there's still the pull for some people to the Negro-American culture as distinguished from the white middle-class world of the outside.
A Negro never had any American culture. The nearest thing he had to it is something that whites have adopted, and that was the Negro spiritual, which is the only original music that America has ever produced. But there was not much Negro culture. His church is different than the white church, but now as the churches have gotten larger and wealthier and the ministers better educated, you know, here's a fact that's amazing. I'm sure you know about it, but very few people do. There are more Negro young people in the United States out of a population of 20 million going to colleges and universities than all of the young people of England out of a population of 56 million.
I didn't know that.
I know it. Very few people know it. It's a statistic from the Bureau of Census,
Well, you've been laying over there since 1960. More than it's amazing. When I read it, I was just shocked. And this indicates the fact that the Negro has a responsibility. And compared to England, indicates the fact that he's interested in being an American. And the Negro College is fading. The Negro Press has come back because it was almost on its last legs, but its circulation is up now because it's the organ of protest of the revolution. The Negro Church always will be strong as it is because people go to the church around the corner. But there are a lot of whites going into fringe area churches, and a lot of Negroes going into white churches, and a lot of churches beginning to have a Negro clergyman even in mixed congregations.
One in a town I know in Vermont, considering a Negro clergyman.
Well, I instituted the interracial project in Vermont around 20 years ago.
You did?
Where at our opening event in my church, we sent about 50 youngsters to Vermont to areas where they'd never even seen Negroes in some areas, and then the farmers there would take them in as their guests for a two-week period. Then in the wintertime, they'd charter a bus, and 40 or 50 would come down and spend a weekend living in the Harlem apartments and worshiping.
I was in it.
There's no Negro in this township that I'm thinking about. Mm-hmm. I suppose there's never been one.
They're probably able to hire him because he's better trained than the salary they would offer to someone from Yale Divinity or Harvard Divinity.
In the town in Kentucky where I was born at one time, there was a Cornell doctor, PhD, principal of the Negro school, and the principal of the white school, I should say, was semi-literate.
That's right. We have problems like that in government here, where we have supervisors or high school graduates over men with bachelors and masters. One of the things we're fighting right now, President's Committee.
Myrdal says in his big book that the ideal program for the reconstruction of the South after the Civil War would have had these, among other provisions. One,
compensation to the now ex-slave holders for the ex-slaves, whatever, quotes, property. Two, expropriation of land, but compensation to the planter. Three, land distributed to the freedmen, but not as gift, as a long-term...
40 acres and a mule.
But not as a gift, but as a sale, supervised sale. And there's other kinds of protection, plus movement of population. Taking a certain number of Negroes and resetting on public lands. Do those things strike you as reasonable?
Well, they were in those days, because Myrdal was copying that from what Queen Victoria did.
Yes, you had a comp.
When Queen Victoria freed the slaves, she paid everyone.
Yes.
She got them land, and the bitterness and the friction was not there.
Well, it clearly was not going, it didn't happen here anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But you would find no resistance to the idea.
No, none whatsoever.
It's strange how often there's a vast emotional resistance to this idea on the part of both Negroes and whites as condoning a moral wrong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Isolating the moral question from any other context.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was, as Myrdal points out,
it wasn't the moral wrong only, it was an economic loss. And just like a compensation now to Israel for the Jews that were murdered and their land was taken, it's been worked out between West Germany and Israel.
That is, you don't conceive of such a moral question as out of a context, as an absolute. You want to see it in terms of its human, economic, and social context.
Absolutely correct.
That's a big spit along discussions of all kinds, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Now, we take our Manpower Development Training Act, which was the...
I'm sorry, I'm on shift.
Okay.
This is the end of tape one of the conversations. Mr. Adam Clayton Powell, see tape two.
Excuse me a second. This is tape two of the conversation. Mr. Powell, proceed.
On that business...